Hey, it's Matt from Solidarity House, and this is the 13th episode of Cowboys on the Commons, but it's the 50th episode we've posted of all of our series since we started Solidarity House as a cooperative production company last year. So I want to thank all of our crew, past and present. They are cooperative members of this project, most of whom live here at Solidarity Collective, some who lived here for a while, a couple who are active supporters of the project who live outside of the commune, but spend a great deal of time here helping us build our little utopian village in dystopian southeastern Wyoming. Thanks everybody. Welcome to episode 50, aka episode 13 of Cowboys on the Commons, entitled Sharp Left Turns and featuring my colleague and friend Adriel Hampton. A couple of important things before we play that interview. First, a huge shout out to the public school teachers of Chicago who are about to go on strike. It looks like tomorrow, although that will probably be today for most of the first wave of listeners to this episode. The media is emphasizing, of course, like they always do, that the kids are going to miss school, there are burdens on the parents. They're quoting Mayor Lightfoot, who is calling the CTU unreasonable. And on behalf of Solidarity House, I just want to say, strike, strike, strike. Strike for higher pay, strike for smaller class sizes, strike because it's not your fault. It's not the fault of Chicago's working people or teachers that CPS is underfunded and neglected. It wasn't your fault that those entrusted years ago to take care of CPS gambled away public money on derivatives and interest rate swaps, wrecking the schools financially for nothing. It's not your fault that the right continues to vilify public education while scamming people into for-profit scammy schools. It's not your fault that the centrists and the neoliberals go along with it, towing the line so that they can get a cut of that education blood money. Strike, strike, strike. You are heroes. We are with you, and I expect that a large contingent of supporters from Chicago and surrounding areas will be by your side there. Solidarity to the Chicago teachers. Thank you for everything you do, including having the courage to strike. Second thing, we need your help. Solidarity House Cooperative offers our primary media content, our on-site educational and political events, our collaborative art space, 100% free of charge. Between podcast episodes, live feeds, brunches, educational forum, movie nights, and other offerings, this comes out to around 20 free goods and services and events being offered up every month here out of Solidarity House. We do this while supporting the restoration of 3 acres of land and the structures on it for cooperative living, work, and activism. Activists, artists, and musicians from around the country stay at the space for free as they travel along the I-80 corridor or travel from north to south or south to north. You can hear many of them on the podcasts and see them on our videos. If you like what we're doing, if you like the guests we interview, the subjects we cover on our multiple series, and the fact that we exist, please become a stakeholder. Please become a subscriber for $5 a month at patreon.com/solidarityhouse. That's patreon.com/solidarityhouse. Don't miss our upcoming limited series, Music on the Commons, conversations about politics and music with J. Scott Rodriguez and myself, and a bunch of guests full of musical history and fascinating stories, and keep watching for our other series content as well. I first met Adriel Hampton when he ran for U.S. Congress in 2008. I did some volunteer policy research for him, and we stayed in touch, and I still work with him on political campaigns and content production for some of the many projects that he juggles. He's a digital media, fundraising, and organizing strategist. He runs the Adriel Hampton Group and a progressive PAC called the Really Online Lefty League.
In the interest of full disclosure, our guest today, Adriel Hampton, is a colleague of mine. I do work for his group, the Adriel Hampton Group. We work together and have worked together on a bunch of other projects. And in spite of that, we're still friends. So that's a big bonus. How are you doing this morning, Adriel?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Matt. It's good to be on the podcast.
It is. And it's an exciting time politically, don't you think?
Every day, man.
I wanted to start by getting your impression on this very fresh news. Some people said that it wasn't a surprise. I was a little surprised at how quickly it came, but this is the news that Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have all come out to endorse Bernie.
I was really excited by it. I also was surprised, and it seemed like people in my network were surprised. So you must be talking to some super insiders. You know, I was basically wrapping up watching the debates, and all of a sudden people like, you know, I heard, I think it was Chris Cuomo on CNN was like, AOC is going to endorse him. And I think it was in the Washington Post maybe a bit earlier. But I was caught up in the presidential debates. I think it's really exciting. I think it's really good news. I was discussing it with someone, whether or not it is baked in, right, to, you know, do people who support Bernie already support AOC, and is it going to make a difference? And I think it does. I think that because AOC and Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, they represent a new generation of progressive leadership, and they're all new members of Congress. I think it's a really big deal for them to endorse a, you know, lion of the Senate like Bernie Sanders. And I think it's going to make a difference in the energy of his campaign and the excitement. I know I got really excited. It's been grueling lately, you know, both with Bernie slipping a bit in the polls and also with his health scare. But he looked great last night, and I think this is going to really be a boost. And, you know, I did hear someone said, well, you know, if this had happened right before the Iowa primaries, that would give him a news bump and that would be more significant. But I think this is also a good time for new energy in the campaign. And I hope, you know, that they will be able to do significant surrogate work as well, because I think that any of those three women can draw a crowd by themselves.
I think that a lot of people keep assuming that energy is peaking too early before Iowa, but yeah. I don't see any evidence of that. I haven't seen a ceiling on the energy of the campaign, and that could be just the political moment that we're in, or sort of the historical moment that we're in with, you know, such a horrible administration and with a candidate like Bernie, whose campaign is really centered around not just replacing Trump, but solving for Trumpism, if you know what I mean.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the other news that came out right before the debate was that Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, is not going to call a vote for impeachment. And that's been a sticking point just because the administration has been so recalcitrant about responding to subpoenas. And making an argument that this is not a real impeachment proceeding while the House is in this investigatory stage. Now, it's been interesting because the House is definitely getting witnesses. You know, there are cooperative witnesses from the State Department. But I think in the age of Trump, you do have to, like, the news cycle is so much more aggressive. It's so staccato. You know, it's like, I think, I heard that Trump did something like 400 tweets in the last couple of weeks, mm-hmm. just like utterly insane. And I think it's good for progressives to have their own steady drumbeat of news. I think that by Iowa, a lot of opinions are going to be heavily baked in. Like, how do you not have an opinion, you know, by the time February rolls around? So it'll be really interesting to see what happens. You know, February 3rd, it's not that far off.
Right. There seems to be an assumption in terms of the left that there is a dichotomy between maybe more liberal centrist leaning folks who are really obsessed about Trump and who kind of assume that all of the problems that we're facing began in, you know, in 2016, 2017, and there were no problems before then. And then, maybe younger and more radicalized folks who really kind of eschew and sort of dismiss a lot of the Trump-centered politics of the liberal left. Do you feel like that's a false dichotomy, or do you feel like, I mean, I've noticed, you know, for example, in, you know, a lot of insurgent campaigns and primary challenges, that a lot of these candidates are not really buying that dichotomy. They're taking on Trump. They're taking on liberal complicity in the House. And they're also saying that a better world is possible.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that there very clearly is, in a place like Twitter, you know, which is hyper politicized, where it's a smaller a segment of the population. But one of the things that's incredibly important if you are a candidate is you have to get beyond 50%. So you can't let those kind of dichotomies dominate your campaign. But in the context of what we were just talking about with Bernie Sanders, his campaign is very geared towards grabbing another group of folks that aren't in that dichotomy. And those are folks who just tuned out of politics. And I think that there's all kinds of folks who've tuned out of politics. There's 100 million eligible voters who, you know, didn't vote in the last presidential election. But I think a big part of that is folks don't see politics as significant to their daily lives. And I think that that's why often you see presidential candidates talk about, you know, some kind of tax break, which will hit, you know, middle income folks, trying to get them to actually vote. But with the Sanders campaign and with a lot of the progressive congressional campaigns, what you see is folks really hitting at issues that will help folks who've maybe fallen off the economic ladder, people who have significant amounts of student debt. You know, you have both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren proposing tuition debt relief plans, Bernie wanting to wipe it out entirely. You have the new, you know, the school lunch proposal that came out yesterday from Bernie Sanders and Rep. Omar. Which would make sure that every kid at a public school gets to eat a decent meal with no shame, no questions about whether or not they can afford it, and having the federal government pick up the tab if the schools have students who need that assistance. And, you know, the question is, does that bring up more voters? Now, I do see, I'm on Twitter a lot. It was not my first social network. That was LinkedIn, but I ran for Congress in 2009, basically using Twitter as a vehicle to get media attention, and did get a lot, and kind of ran a Twitter campaign, and know from personal experience that that doesn't work. And also, you know, from contemporary experience, just reading Twitter, that it's much more polarized than average folks. I'll tell you, I had an interesting experience. There's, you know, you may be familiar with a lot of kind of Bernie or bust folks, which I would say, you know, is definitely a significant group, but it's not a large group in terms of what you need to win Democratic elections. And there are folks who are very anti-Warren. I was in a recreation center over the weekend, and I was listening to a gentleman talking to three other folks, and they were all seniors. And he was saying, you know, her plan for Medicare is going to take away your Medicare because she wants Medicare for all. And that means that, you know, everybody gets the same thing. You don't get to choose what you want. And I thought, like, how crazy is it that people online are like attacking Elizabeth Warren for not being good enough on Medicare, and out in the real world, people are attacking her for supporting it, right? And it just, I think that disinformation spreads more readily now probably than any time before, because it's so easy to inject vitriol into online conversations. It's very easy for people to, you know, hide their identity or their intent. You know, just like you started out saying that you do some work for my firm. You know, like, if you didn't say that, like, how would people find out, right? And you've got a podcast, right? Everyone can have a podcast. Everyone can have a Twitter. A lot of those can be anonymous or semi-anonymous. And I really think the biggest challenge for progressives going into 2020 is how do we reach plurality? How do we reach a majority in these elections, in these primaries? It can't be just hiding out in, in a specific demographic or even a specific ideology. Unfortunately, like I would love to say, like we can only let in people who are, 100%. They've been for single payer for 20 years, right? When I ran in 2009, single payer was one of my issues. A big part of the role of activists is to hold politicians accountable and push them. And what's great, we see, Bernie's positions being much more mainstream and the ones that are being debated rather than mocked or pushed off to the side. And I hope that the folks who have been working on single payer for 10, 20 years, 30 years or longer are pleased with that. And obviously, now I think we have a larger group of folks who are following progressive news. Like there just was not, there was like Daily Kos in like 2009, right?
Right.
And that was about it. Yeah.
I remember because it was kind of, Kos was kind of edgy at that time.
Right, right. And now it's not only is it in the left considered like mainstream, it's even, like kind of over on the complacent side. They definitely have, they use rhetoric, to get people to sign petitions, but it's not considered vanguard for the left. And that's because there's a whole community of folks who've developed around the left, Democratic Socialists, Bernie Sanders supporters, Bernie-crats. I am very happy about that as someone who ran, openly as a socialist, someone who believes that the wealth of society needs to be shared, that we need everyone to benefit from the fruits of their labors, and that you shouldn't have CEOs who make hundreds of times as much as their employees, and the employees have zero voice in their workplace.
I think one of the biggest changes that I've seen that people maybe don't put at the forefront of their list of changes, and this is something that Bernie has had a lot to do with, and frankly, this is something that your work has had a lot to do with, and that is this new era of fundraising. Of that a candidate can become a dominant candidate through fundraising small contributions, thousands of small contributions or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of small donations. And so talk a little bit about how tech has made this possible and maybe kind of some of the potential that you see that changing both our political discourse and our political praxis.
My most recent experiences with online fundraising were with the Shahid for Change campaign against Nancy Pelosi. It's Shahid Buttar, a constitutional lawyer and DJ out of San Francisco, who primaried Pelosi in 18, and is running again in 2020. In 2018, I was not able to work with him because I had been working with another candidate previously in the primary and just didn't feel comfortable. When I had created a campaign plan for someone, going over to a rival later, even though I was not working for anyone at the time of the primary. But this time I helped Shahid set up his digital infrastructure, everything from his website to different ActBlue landing pages. And I also was a senior advisor to the Mike Gravel campaign, where we were able to get 67,000 donations in just a few months. And actually, it was more donations than that, over 70,000, or 67,000 individual donors. So, and Shahid's campaign has more than 6,000, which I think my work was, contributed to about 5,000 of those, and he's got a great team now carrying it on. I'm not presently consulting on anything except Facebook work. I'm presently working with a company called Action Sprout that helps candidates with their Facebook engagement advertising, which is different than fundraising. Back in 2017, we wrote an ebook about online fundraising, and some things have changed, but the fundamentals are still the same. One is that ActBlue, they have, I believe, it's 7 million Democrats who've made donations or saved their information with ActBlue in some manner. I'm not sure if you can save it without being a donor. And I think that doesn't include people who are like one-offs who don't store their credit card information. So the Democrats have been very successful in creating an online one-click donation system that really makes it easy for grassroots supporters to participate. And Act Blue is like one of the, you know, the kind of senior citizens of the digital political world. They've been around for some time. But I think what really, I think there are three races that are significant. One is the John Ossoff race for Congress. One is the Bernie Sanders presidential run in 2016, and also Beto O'Rourke's challenge to Ted Cruz. In each of those, you saw, and Sanders most significantly, because it was a nationwide, you know, presidential race, you saw very significant numbers of online fundraising. Now, it's also important to note that it's a small number of politicians who can raise tens of thousands of donations. You have to have a profile. You have to have a race that's significant enough for national attention. Usually, you know, you need an opponent like a Ted Cruz or in the case of a Democratic primary, with Buttar being Nancy Pelosi, someone who's polarizing. And, you know, you and I have worked together on some of the email fundraising piece. I think that email fundraising is still king, especially if you are not, if you don't have one of those elements, a really high profile race, you know, a large race or a polarizing opponent. It's much, much easier for me to raise money for Shahid Buttar than it is to raise money for someone who's running in a Democratic primary against someone no one's ever heard of. And I think that that's difficult because, you know, people see like Shahid's success and they go, oh, you know, I want that. I want Adriel to help me, you know, and like I could jump in. And I think at this point on the progressive left, I've probably, you know, been part of larger fundraising campaigns than just about any consultant on the grassroots level. You were raising thousands of contributions, averaging around $20, right? However, that's incredibly difficult to do in a low profile race. And I have worked on low profile races and I can raise money, but you know, it's more like a few thousand dollars a month. It's not, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50. The Justice Democrats, I think, are another huge factor here. And that's because they, you know, birthed out of you know, Kyle Kulinski and Cenk Uygur. And they had a huge email list like right out the gate. And then they used that email list to raise money for their endorsed candidates and to help them build their campaigns. And that's what, you know, you need. You need those huge email lists. And we mentioned Daily Kos. You know, they, I popped on there the other day for some reason and they were, they had a petition for Elizabeth Warren and a banner ad for Kamala Harris. And what they're doing is harvesting their members' email addresses for those presidential campaigns. And, you know, needing a large email list is, or at least a significant email list is a start of it. But for folks who are just, you know, getting started and don't have that high profile race, I think the most important thing is to build a friends and family email list. Honestly, if you don't have thousands of emails available when you're starting out, you probably shouldn't be running for a high office. You should probably be running for a city council or, you know, a school board or trying to get a position in local government that's appointed. Running for Congress does require a lot of money. Partly, I think what people don't realize is that these are marketing advertising campaigns. No matter how good your organizing is, you're never going to reach enough voters to hit your win number directly and persuadably. And so you need to shape opinion and raise your name recognition high enough that you're not just getting a party line vote, right? If you want to change a primary or you want to change, you know, maybe a district that has more Republicans than Democrats, or you want to fire up the Democrats, or maybe what I've seen in California, where I live, is that Republicans vote at such high propensity. I've seen elections where they're voting at like twice the rate of independent voters, for example, and independent, I mean, nonpartisan, you know, not registered with the Democrats or the Republicans. And in California, that's a very large number of folks. So if the Republicans are outvoting them twice, 2-1, it doesn't matter that the independents outnumber the Republicans. The Republicans just swamp them at the ballot box, right? So if you're a Democrat, you have to be reaching those folks. And you have to be doing both grassroots organizing, what we call field organizing, and advertising and marketing. You know, and fundraising, it's email fundraising. And then some candidates have a lot of luck with Facebook advertising that's geared to get them ads. One thing we've seen in the presidential race that's really interesting is because the DNC made a criteria of debate entry, the number of donations you'd received, all of these candidates have been scrambling for these small donors. And these are all going into the Act Blue database. And I assume that it has grown a lot. But you also hear things like candidates paying up to $100 for a $1 donation. And certainly a grassroots candidate is not going to do that. That's what happens when you get big donations. And then you use those big donations to get the grassroots support. It's kind of, it's an astroturfing kind of thing.
One last issue that I wanted to talk to you about, and I've wanted to ask you about this for a long time, because you're someone who has had your finger on the pulse of social media for many, many years before a lot of other political activists did. You're familiar with the dynamics of Facebook and Twitter. So last week, or in the last couple of weeks, Judd Legum has come out with a lot of revelations, maybe just specific knowledge of what we generally knew to be true before, which is that, you know, there are these projects, you know, where people are creating these sort of fake numbers of people. They're often, you know, coming from other countries. This obviously was a factor in the 2016 election. The recent work that Judd has done, you know, has talked about this Ukrainian-based pro-Trump Facebook page that had pro-cop stuff, all kinds of America First stuff and everything. And obviously the ongoing kind of concern is that this is going to manipulate the public so much that it could end up swinging elections. And I'm just wondering what your general thoughts are about these sort of mass manipulation efforts on the part of, you know, these nefarious entities.
Yeah, I really appreciate Judd's reporting. I'm a sponsoring subscriber to his newsletter and read it just about religiously. And I even got my dad to sign up. I especially appreciate the reporting on Facebook advertising. Now, the case you bring up about Ukrainians with Facebook pages, what's crazy about Facebook now, I have to say that I'm a huge critic of Facebook, and I really hope that we do get a presidential candidate who will take on big tech, because I think even worse, you know, we've had like big pharma and big oil. Like big oil now, we know, is not just creating environmental problems; they're an existential threat to life on Earth, right? So that's become more and more serious. But big tech has emerged, you know, as a lobbying group, as a significant force in politics, and the scariest thing about it is the ability to spread propaganda, and also to spread, I would almost say it's like it's infecting people's emotions. And this example you brought up with the puppies, but also the I love cops and the Trump rhetoric, it was also things like puppies, pictures of puppies, animal pictures. And what they're doing is they're using the Facebook algorithm rewards engagement. I'll give you an example. Is there a campaign I was advising on Facebook, and we were running an endorsement from Tim Kaine, a picture of Tim Kaine. And the conservatives were the cheapest people to reach because they troll the comments really, really hard. And Facebook spreads a post in news feeds based on comments. So when a MAGA person comments, it pushes out to all their friends. Now, if their friends are persuadable, that can be good, but it's crazy because the advertising cost drops dramatically because of that organic activity, and Facebook rewards that. And so when they say that Trump himself is able to advertise more cheaply because his audience is reactionary and primed to live in the comments. So this Ukrainian operation, and it's just one of a number that Judd has revealed in recent weeks, and he's also really been on top of this policy where just in the last week or so, Facebook changed its rules for advertisers to exempt political advertising from truth in advertising rules that they had ostensibly enforced. Now, what Judd often finds is that they're not enforcing their own rules at all, but he's really on top of Trump, who does a lot of things like when you're doing online fundraising or list building, urgency is really important. Fear is a really important emotion. I always try to use hope, but urgency is incredibly important. So they'd have something like, deadline 11:59, you know, get your name on this. We're going to give it to Trump. And I've seen Sanders use that same kind of language, like get us, you know, if you donate before the debate, we're going to get Bernie a list of all the people who donated before the debate. And, you know, and I'll give them the benefit of the doubt that they're really doing that. And Trump, I don't. And Judd has over and over pointed out these examples where it's impossible for his deadlines to be true. Because, for example, they'll say, you know, this ends at this time. And then the next day, it's running again, right? And Facebook has not only not enforced truth in advertising, but they have now specifically exempted political figures. And that's extremely troubling because of this infectious nature of the emotions that Facebook advertising stirs up and rewards. So the Ukrainians were doing marketing. They weren't even trying, as far as Judd's reporting could tell, they weren't trying to elect Trump. They were just trying to make money. And it's that these negative emotions around Trump, whether you're a supporter or an opponent, there's negative emotions generated, like anger about the other, right? That's really what Trump likes to gin up. And so you end up rewarding that behavior. And so then you have these organic pages. They're not advertising. They're running highly engaging, highly viral. And what they're doing is something that every kind of top tier Facebook page operator knows, which is you basically look for things that are trending or have trended in the past, viral content. You make enough changes that the original owner of that content is not going to come after you, or that it's not going to look exactly identical. Like you change, you know, the color of the headline and maybe slightly change the language. Maybe use a different picture of Trump than someone else used, or a different picture of the cute dog, different picture of cops at a funeral, whatever it is. That's highly emotional. And then you push that out. And in Judd's reporting, I saw they said that they usually only needed to change about 20% of the image and it would still work. And they probably also, you know, you end up with a library of things, right? You could have 10 versions of the same meme, but they're different enough that they'll go viral again. And how do they profit off this, right? They're not getting, in this case, they weren't getting paid, as far as we know, from an oligarch. They want people then to click through to link to their clickbait websites that are full of programmatic ads from Google. And when you go on the page with the programmatic ads, you know, maybe every visitor is worth, you know, a few cents. I don't know exactly the economy of it, but these guys, after their page network got taken down due to Judd's reporting, they were bemoaning the fact that they were losing like $50,000 a month is what they had projected they were going to earn from the viral activity on those pages and clicking on link bait. So you, and this is true for non-US actors who are trying to make money on Facebook. It's true for large operators, you know, in the U.S., both on the liberal progressive side and the conservative side. And so it's a big significant problem, right? Because just so people can make money, these opinions are being moved. Like the Ukrainians didn't care at all about what the content was doing to the recipient as long as they're making money. And to some extent, you know, because Facebook is an attention economy, it is really rewarding those bad behaviors. And I applaud Judd, but sometimes I feel like, you know, it's like swimming upstream. And I do appreciate the work that Elizabeth Warren has been doing to call attention to this. I think, you know, it's becoming more known in the mainstream when she did that stunt in the last week with saying that Zuckerberg can endorse Trump. And then it's like, oh, no, not really. But, you know, it's okay to lie in Facebook ads. I think that, you know, caught folks who aren't experts in online media and, you know, caught their attention, I hope. Yeah, it's scary stuff. And Facebook is, you know, not only showing that they aren't taking care of this problem, but with this latest move in the Truth in Advertising for political ads, they're showing that they have very little intention to enforce standards on their platform in a fair way. You know, obviously, I think if you're, you know, that the Ukrainian operation got bumped off because it was bad publicity, but Trump is not getting bumped off despite lies in his ads.
What are some movements and organizations that have momentum right now that give you joy and hope? What are some candidates that, you know, people need to be taking harder looks at also have that kind of potential to reshape American political discourse?
You know, I've been slightly grim of late. And I can't put it exactly, but I think it's because of, I'm really not happy with the amount of trolling of Elizabeth Warren by Bernie supporters. I just think that has put me in a bad mood in general over the past few weeks. I think that in a democracy where you have to get, you know, you have to get a majority of the vote, that you should build alliances. But the things that do, I mean, one, I guess it was great to watch the debate last night and see both Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, you know, defending and fighting for Medicare for all. And in Bernie's case, you know, for the end of low tax rates that that reward billionaires and allow them to dominate our culture and our societies. I think I am also excited about impeachment. I don't like every figure involved, but I think that that you have to hold criminal presidents accountable. It's something we didn't see with the Bush administration, you know, and a war built on lies that cost hundreds of thousands of lives. I think that with Trump, you know, he's always trying to dominate the news cycle, and having an impeachment inquiry going on, these hearings and witness testimony is a way of fighting back. I think Extinction Rebellion, I'm really excited about. You know, it's mostly work in the UK, but folks taking, and also the DSA, I see a lot more direct action in this cycle around political issues. You know, just here in San Francisco, there's a district attorney race, and it was the first open district attorney race in 110 years. And then, everyone knew that the incumbent was not running for reelection, but then he, a month before voting, so, you know, early October, stepped down, and then the mayor immediately appointed, a replacement who was her endorsed candidate. So everyone's like, well, you know, way to tip the scales. And even the ACLU of Northern California condemned that action. And it was wild because I saw they were trying to have a press conference announcing, you know, this appointment. And they were kind of being chased and dogged by victims' rights advocates and parents of young men who'd been shot by the police, and all saying, you know, this is not the right candidate, and then this appointment stinks. And so they basically used police protection to take their press conference into a private place, which is pretty crazy. So they're only letting in their own supporters and the press. But one young person got in and just said, you know, you're subverting our democracy, you know, and kept kind of razzing them until escorted out. You saw the video. Yeah. Right. And I think that that kind of direct action is what's required. You can see with Extinction Rebellion that, you know, folks have to get arrested. They have to take action that's going to wake up a broader, you know, broader opinion in the population. And there's so much propaganda from the right that I think that the direct action, though, starts to break through that level of propaganda. You know, the Ben Shapiro's, the Tucker Carlson's, the Tommy Lahrens, you know, these kind of funded right-wing mouthpieces that are, you know, constantly pouring out opinion and trying to distract. When you think about the issue that 100 million people who were eligible to vote didn't vote last presidential election, you know, we've got a lot to do.
You've also pointed out before that that there's this huge discrepancy that we know about people over 40 versus people under 40 voting, and just what the implications of that would be if those numbers were to go up on the younger side.
Yeah, and there are a lot of very positive trends really out of the 2018 election, and I think we'll continue to see that in 2020 of younger people, generation, you know, if you look at millennials and younger Gen Xers and Zoomers, the starting to trend to be a bigger voting block than the boomers. And I think that that is a really exciting trend. And so, you know, to some extent, it's like we just have to make sure that there's a society for young people to inherit. And I think I feel like as someone who's 41 years old, that that's, you know, part of my job as a human being in this society is to help that transition be a just and smooth. And at this point needs to be a swift one. I'd also just a shameless pitch. If folks are working on campaigns, running campaigns and want to do better with Facebook, particularly around Facebook advertising for visibility, this is something I hammer on because if you send mail pieces, they can cost, you know, 25, 50 cents up to a dollar or more for each piece, depending on what it is, where Facebook, for as much as I dislike it and want it to be regulated and reformed by policymakers, it is the place right now to reach older voters and to reach the masses. You just, if you're spending a lot of time on Twitter, you know, you're kind of, you're reaching the pundit, Yeah, that's, I'll make
right,
that word.
Right.
But Facebook is where you're going to reach, you know, the everyday voter. And so I've been doing a lot of work. I'm creating a training network sponsored by Action Sprout that teaches folks how to use Facebook engagement advertising. And folks can just reach out to me. I'm Adriel at adrielhampton.com or Adriel Hampton on Twitter. And happy to invite folks. It's right now it's invite access at no charge. And even folks who, if folks give feedback on the courses that I've written there, you get half off a year of Action Sprout, which is a tool that helps manage Facebook pages. So that's an, again, as much as I dislike Facebook and I have deleted my account on multiple occasions, there's videos out there of me talking about like why I'm deleting my Facebook account, you know, from several years ago. I do think that, you know, it's like if you didn't use TV, you know, during the Nixon Kennedy years.
Right. Right.
And you've got to understand and use the tools that are available. And hopefully Judd will keep them honest.
No, I mean, we definitely need those kinds of watchdogs. And I was so happy when he jumped that to the Center for American Progress ship and went on to his own. He's, he, I mean, he's just made some incredible contributions since then. And I want to say that the thing that that I find most heartening about what we're talking about is, and especially with, certainly epitomized by groups like DSA, Extinction Rebellion, and these new grassroots candidates, that there is this breakdown of the dichotomy between direct action and electoral politics.
Right.
Because for most of my activist life, that's been this huge dichotomy that's sort of been waved in people's faces. You have to choose one or the other to, you know, and that your participation in electoral politics means that you're selling out, or your participation in direct action means that you're being utopian and not realistic about how change occurs. And, you know, you've got this, this wave, and it's really driven by young people under 40. And it is this, this refusal to pick a side in that particular dichotomy.
Yeah, I think that that's really powerful. Thanks for bringing it up.
Yeah. Well, it's been great to talk to you as always. Let's do this again.
All right. Great. Thanks a lot, Matt.
Yeah. Take care.
Thanks everyone for listening.